Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello friends, welcome back to In The Pink. This week we are going to go for something slightly different because we are going for the best bits of the last series. There have been loads of highlights, there have been loads of great guests. I'm really grateful to all of them for their time. But we're going to try and pick out some of our favourite moments, perhaps, you know, the most insightful bits on each podcast into the guest, the interviewee. And it's difficult to know where to start because I have spoken to so many cool people over the last few weeks. But I think probably Anna Push, well, she's definitely on the podium of my favourite ones, if not my favourite on the top step. It's Kelly Holmes. She has and always will be a hero of mine. Winning double Olympic gold was quite remarkable. More so when you realise, understand and learn that she was in fact battling all sorts of demons at the time. So for her to be able to compartmentalise, if you like, put those to one side and deliver on the greatest stage of them all in such a physical way is truly astonishing. So let's hear from Kelly first on that double Olympic gold win.
No, I always believed I could be Olympic champion since I was 14. I do not know why it was so embedded in my head and my heart. I just always believed it. And when I won the 800 metres, the one where my eyes were popping out of my head, I never expected to win the 800. I never did, even at that stage.
Well, it was fairly late in the day you deciding to even do it, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'd had a 12-year international career. I'd won, prior to the Olympics, 12 international medals, 5 at 800 and 5 at 15. And so what happened was, is in the in 2004, it was the first year in 7 that I hadn't been injured. So everything really went well for me, consistency of training, you know, really increased my self-esteem back, my confidence back, had a great team around me, and I was just flying and training. And it was almost come to that realisation that it's probably going to be my last Olympics, it was my third anyway, that I was in the shape of my life. And if I came back for two medals, any colour, what a great end to a year, and I really believe I could medal at the Games because my time suggested it, and I was really, really confident in my ability.
And you'd medalled in Sydney.
I'd medalled in Sydney, 800 metres. I'd gone fourth in 96, running with a stress fracture. You know, so I'd done loads of things. So I always knew I could do it, but it was that real confirmation that year that it's all going really well. I can only mess it up, really. And obviously my body could have, but my team were brilliant. And so when I did the 800... when I cross the line, I'll tell you what, because I do motivational speaking now on stage, and I always play this because everyone loves the little montage, don't they? And it is that thing where I literally won by thickness of, let's say somebody's wearing a shirt or T-shirt, 0.05 of a second separated the first four of us. That's how close it was. But that side of a win is all right, isn't it? Because when you come fourth and you lose by that much, it sucks. And I've come fourth at one of the Olympics before by less than a tenth of a second.
I mean, it's crazy. That's like Formula One margins.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just minuscule, isn't it?
Just that bit is a difference between complete glory Olympic champion and being an also run and in fourth, you know. So when I crossed the line, though, this is the thing. I crossed the line and I started to celebrate. And this is what people see on my little video. But then I suddenly thought to myself, oh my God, I couldn't have won. You know, it's like this thing, oh, and I thought I was celebrating prematurely, and I'm like bringing my arms out, like, ah, oh, you know, kind of like the face is coming down, thinking, oh God, what's happened? And I'm looking on the inside of this track, and the British photographer's jumping up and down like a madman. He's going, Kelly, you've won. And I reacted and I won. I met him 3 months later. He said, Kelly, best night of my life ever. Also the worst, didn't get one bloody photo of you. And he was a British photographer, you know, jumping mad for his cameras.
Because he was so swept away by the moment.
Exactly.
Oh, that's lovely, but, though, isn't
yeah.
it?
So that was, yeah, just something that I crossed the line. I just like, wow, I just could not believe it. Because it's a moment. You know, this took me 20 years of dreaming. That wasn't just the athletics career. I dreamt of winning a gold medal, not that one, hence why I went for the 15, for 20 years. I'd always believed I could get it.
Okay, next up, another one on my podium for this series. Again, battling it out with Kelly for the top spot. It's got to be Tubes. Grown up with him, watching him on TV, loved him, Soccer AM, over the years. Who knew that so much was going on for him behind the scenes as well? So here is Tubes talking about that crucial moment when he realised something had to give and he had to start beating his battle, his addiction with alcohol.
I've moved back to live with mum to look after her. And she's like, every time I left the house, she'd be like, oh God, what's going to happen?
So she knew there was a problem?
Yeah. I think a lot of people did. Mm. I wouldn't admit it. And if you're an alcoholic, the only person who can help you is you to say, I've got a problem. I need to stop.
But was there a catalyst for that?
Yeah.
So what was the moment when you realised you could change?
So I was coming to terms with it, and I kept trying to do it, like come off it, and so I managed to do like 3 or 4 weeks, but then I'd split up with a girlfriend and be like, oh, fuck that, just drink again. So anyway, I got offered to do one of these paid gigs in Manchester, and I still know when people say, oh, do you want to come and do this? And that will give you a bit of money. I'm like, I'm so lucky. Like, it's amazing. Like, I'm like, this is the best. You know, I'm so, you know.
And there's always a part of you that thinks that might, those offers might dry up. You know, you've got to take them when they're there.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I do that. It was a right laugh. Mm. It was some building company, and I just had to sort of muck around. And I was like, that comes quite natural to me. I'm happy days. So I went and did that. And then afterwards they went, oh, do you want a beer? I was like, I'm not supposed to be drinking. I went, oh, do you know what, sod it. No one here, I'm not going to upset anyone, like my family or my brother or my mum. So I was like, well, I'm going home tomorrow anyway. So I was like, yeah. So it was a nice, hot summer's day. I just don't know, whatever it was. And I was like, yeah, I'm like, this is really cool. Like, everyone's like, oh, you're brilliant, really funny. And I was like, oh, great. So then as soon as the first Cronenberg, like half of it went down, I was like, it just gave me this massive buzz. Like a feeling of like, yes, like, do you know what I mean? It was like, it's like injecting yourself with something. I've never taken drugs, but it was like, oh wow, like everything's brilliant, like, you know, do you know what I mean? So then there's I couldn't stop. I could not stop at one. I tried it once and it was like, I was proper gagging. Like, people, you know, when people say, you don't go in the pub for one, you know, they make jokes, you can't just go for one or two. I literally couldn't. I've seen my mates do it. Quick in, pint, see your boys home. And I used to look at them, even when I was young, going, how have they done that? Because I couldn't do it. I'd be planning the next one, especially later on down the line. So anyway, pints, went into Manchester. I think I told some of my mates to come up. They jumped on a train, went to Manchester. Did the classic again, woke up the next morning in a hotel room, mini bar, doo-doo, took it all. And they were staying up or something. So, and then that was it. You know when you're like a kid at Christmas and you know that your stocking's there and you're, you know, your Christmas present's done and you get so excited. I was looking, so I had a few of the vodkas from the minibar. Then I walked into Manchester and I saw a pub and it was open. It was like 6:30 in the morning because I was doing my usual scout around trying to get more alcohol, but all the shops were closed. And I saw a pub, a Wetherspoons. It was open, and I've got that feeling, it's like, oh my God, it's like, this is the best thing ever. And how sad's that? Mm. I was like, so I went straight in the pub.
And
like,
you were on your own?
Yeah. Me and my music. I used to love it. That's the actual things I miss about drinking now, is just sitting outside, listening to music, having a few pints, but I can't. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So anyway, I went into this pub, I was like, this is amazing. 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm allowed to drink. No one's looking at me like, weird. Something like that, a few Cronenbergs. They're like, would you like any breakfast there? I was like, oh, absolutely not. I was like, can I have a shot though? And they're like, yeah. They're like, are you the guy from... I was like, yeah. And then I was like, oh, Christ. So then I moved around to the corner. Just sat there for hours, just drinking. Probably talking nonsense to people on the phone. But anyway, next thing I knew, I was in my mum's spare room at home. I woke up, I was like, fucking hell, I was in Manchester. I was like, and I couldn't work it out. So I was like, oh God. So I walked downstairs, tried to put on the act like I did for years, and went, you alright, mum? She's just like that. Couldn't even look at me. I was like, do you know what you've done today? I just guessed, yeah, got the train back, you know, I was a bit tired. She was like, no. She said, I had to drag you all the way down Cobham Station platform. I was like, oh God. And she was in tears. I was like, then the fear came in, I had the shakes. Mum's crying. I was like, this has got to stop. This is absolutely ridiculous. I don't even remember. I lost all my bag. Imagine my poor mum, middle of the afternoon,
and getting over dragging me down. The death of your father as well. This is like a massive...
You selfish bastard. I was like, I've got to stop this. And I did.
That was it.
That was it.
So what happened?
Just said, I'll stop. She's like, I've heard it all before. I was like, no, I'll stop. So I went to one AA meeting that wasn't for me. And I just figured out, if I don't put that first drink to my mouth, these 5 days that follow won't happen. So I started slowly. It was hard. Because my whole life was like, Chelsea. Because I got a season ticket at Chelsea. Mm. Chelsea's drink day. I sometimes wouldn't even remember the match. So all those little triggers, like Chelsea, after the interview, the buzz came, and then the like drink came. So I was like, no. And then I found the gym. So I was like, right, I need to do something.
Got to get that fix from somewhere.
I need to get a buzz from somewhere. I need the buzz. So.
Hmm. And when was the gym enough for that?
It had to be, because I couldn't let my mum be like that again.
No.
Okay, next up on In the Pink Best Bits, it's Denise Van Outen. Everyone's favourite blonde bombshell on the telly. She talks to me about her rise to fame on The Big Breakfast. Again, Appointment to View television that we all grew up with. And her friendship with Johnny Vaughan. Now, you have to remember, the chemistry on screen between those two was just ridiculous. Everyone just assumed they must be a couple, surely. And actually, she explains that they were anything but, and the subsequent breakdown of their friendship, which, you know, has been well documented in the press. But anyway, Denise gives us a great insight into her life through her bubbly and beautiful personality. So over to you, Denise, for your best bit.
I laughed every day. Like, we literally used to laugh to the point where I was going to wet myself. We just, you know, you have those mates, don't you, sometimes, where you just click. Yeah. And it was instant. We just got on.
Yeah.
And it's really weird, really, because it's like we've never, obviously, then things happen and we've had fallouts along the way, as people do, which is really sad.
Yeah. And you clearly got on so well. That people probably would be.
Yeah, so there was that slight, which happens with in all workplaces, you know. Yeah. There's always someone, isn't it, that you've got a work buddy that you laugh with and you go home and you don't.
I've just done this road trip with Gethin Jones, who loves you, by the way. Mm. Told him I was doing this.
I love Geth.
And I laughed so much, and I didn't even know why I was laughing at one point. Now, obviously, very happily married, and actually I think he and my husband are more in love with each other than I am with either of them, because they're both massive Welshies and love their rugby. But it's a lovely feeling giggling that much with someone, isn't
it? It's brilliant.
Chemistry is a funny thing. You never know when you're going to get it, who you're going to get it with.
Exactly.
But when it happens, it's great.
So it is, and that was like, he was my real buddy. I just adored him, and I still do. But then things happen within the industry where, obviously, then once the show became really successful, we were in a position to negotiate our contract, and I thought we were doing it together as a team, but his agent had other ideas, and she was obviously trying to negotiate that he got more money, and there was all those kind of arguments that happened with bands, presenters. I mean, in
it's
any
bullshit, really, though,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, because at the end of the day, I just wanted. I wanted to know we were a little team, and became apparent that we were no longer a team.
Mm.
So that was one of the problems. And then, I don't know, we never really got back on track. And it's weird because we message on the odd occasion. And I'm actually, as much as I'm a very confident person, I'm confident, but I'm very sensitive. So they're two very different things, you know, and I do take things to heart. So sometimes when things are said or done, it sits with me, and perhaps I should learn to let them go. But I find it really hard.
But so how do you feel about him now?
I love him to bits, but he also, we've sort of messaged that we should meet up. But I just think sometimes, not to him in particular, but sometimes with other male presenters, when I do meet up with them, or if people in the industry, their ego sort of takes over a little bit, and
yeah,
or they don't want to have the conversation because they just brush it over and go, oh, let's forget about it, move on. It's like, well, you sort of do have to have a conversation,
but sometimes,
to move on.
Sometimes it's down to us girls to force the conversation.
And I've tried. That's what I was saying. Yeah. I have tried, I think.
But you've also got to get to a point where you can't
keep trying.
Twist someone. Yeah.
No, and I'm just like.
But you're in a great place. I mean, more of that.
But I do love him
soon.
To bits, so I'm not saying anything, untoward about him as a person.
That.
It's
totally
just we. It, loads of things, and so much has changed now.
You
know,
grow apart.
Yeah,
doesn't
and
mean
like
you have to be
I don't
best
know his
forever.
Kids, and I don't know his. You know, we don't really know anything about each other anymore.
Yeah, I think it's just. The nation just want you to be besties for life, don't they?
I did always say it'd be quite funny if they did throw us in the jungle together. Then that would be
would
quite
you ever do the jungle?
Oh, I would, yeah. Oh, I have been asked to do it before. Only because I'm a real outdoorsy, love, like I go trekking and camping and do, and that I would love it. But
what about SAS?
No, I wouldn't want to do that.
Too hard.
Yeah, and I don't particularly like being shouted at. Do you know what I mean?
I actually do.
Oh, you dirty cow. Now we know what you're like.
No, it's weird. I quite like discipline.
I will do it, but I want to do it when I want to do it.
In the Pink is sponsored by Bose, who've been perfecting the art of sound so that you can listen in unrivaled comfort. The new Bose Noise Cancelling 700s take it to a whole other level. So you'll always hear exactly what you want, no matter where you are. Also, be heard like never before with their unrivaled 4-microphone system, which isolates your voice whilst cancelling the noise around you. Pretty cool, huh? Always stay connected with Bose's first of its kind augmented reality function that will change the way you think about travel, exercise, and learning. And never be caught out because they have an excellent 20 hours of battery life. They come in black and silver, so you can work them around your style, your little fashionistas. And you can treat your ears with the Bose Noise Cancelling 700s. It's a sound experience like no other. Right, next up on the best bits, David Yarrow, amazing photographer. And he's seen every part of the globe and captured it on camera. He talks to me about his views on climate change, which I think you'll find quite interesting.
First and foremostly, I think we have to be careful that we do not give an Armageddon scenario. And there are a lot of people that think that mainstream conservationists are daft. And they're, of course, they're not. And they probably just emotionally more aware and have a greater spirituality than people that don't think about the fact that we share the planet with other people. But it's not all doom and gloom, and whilst Greta has done a fantastic job in terms of putting it on the front lawn of every household in the UK and in the world in a way that adults didn't do, the message maybe is too one-dimensional, and the picture is more mixed than perhaps she portrayed it to be. And there's not easy solutions to population growth. If you look at the risks that the world faces, the ones that I worry about least are, firstly, Minneapolis dentist shoots lion. It's barbaric, it's medieval, it's abhorrent, but it's legal in South Africa. At some stage it won't be, but it's not affecting the lion population in the world.
We might not like it. Yeah, we certainly don't like him, but
it's not the issue.
Okay.
Secondly, poaching is equally for either whether it's people snorting rhino horn in Vietnam or whether people using ivory as for ornaments in the Filipino church or in mainland China. It is shocking that that goes on and that trade route is allowed to still happen. Mm. But both at the supply end and the demand end, progress is being made. I'm not saying that the end is in sight of poachers, but it's certainly ameliorating. I think the worst days are not necessarily emphatically behind us. I don't think it's getting any worse. Mm.
But the message is getting through, do you feel?
Yes, exactly. And you know, whether it be Prince Harry, Prince William here, whether it be a huge work from NGOs or American money going into Africa, or organizations dealing with the demand end, like Wild Aid in California with their marketing campaign, which is very persuasive. Things are not getting any worse. The big issues are population growth, and the corollary to that is global warming. I'm not an expert on global warming. The only two things I would say on it are it's clearly been a very hot couple of years. Equally, last year was one of the coldest years in Siberia for a very long time, one of the coldest weeks in Chicago for 40 years. I'm not a doubter. It's just less clear than population growth. And of course the two are linked, so it'd be rather silly for me to say that population growth and climate change are separate issues. They're clearly linked. Mm. But the population of Africa in percentage terms is going to grow an awful lot quicker than the average temperature in the world is in percentage terms. One is dwarfed by the other. Mm. What does that mean? It means that the lion is far more vulnerable than the polar bear. Because where the polar bear lives, people don't want to live. Actually, people are moving from where the polar bear lives because there's no employment opportunities. So you're not going to see population growth in Nunavut, Canada. It's in one of the most sparsely populated. If you're ever flying to LA from the UK or Europe, and the first time you touch land on a clear, or see land on a clear day, and you look out the window in May, April, May, June. I do look out the window and you think, how can anyone possibly live down there? It looks cold and bleak and just thousands of miles of ice. So the polar bear's landscape might have altered a little bit, but the polar bear numbers are static and it would take an awful lot to dissuade me otherwise. And I speak to a lot of scientists in the four countries that look at polar bear numbers, which are America, Canada, Greenland, Denmark, Norway, and Russia. So Greenland and Denmark being one. So they're kind of static at about 35,000, they reckon. The lion is down to about 15, 16,000 because of population growth. It's nothing to do with global warming. It is just the population of Africa is growing. Mm. And it's growing at a rate far beyond anywhere else in the world. And you can look at your numbers for the next 20 years, but I think 80% of the world's population growth in the next 20 years will be in Africa. And it's difficult to know how to address that. You can't get elected on the mandate of zero economic growth or one child per family. So the answers are not going to be natural. They will be contrived answers, which is buying land and allowing those animals to live on that land that you bought without human encroachment. From my perspective, I think we have two roles. Firstly, build awareness. If my show, by having pictures that are close up personal, so you can almost look into the soul of the animal. I posted a picture on Instagram a couple of days ago and I talked about the soul. And someone replied, and I tried not to look too much at Instagram replies, but I saw this one and someone said, "You idiot, animals don't have souls." And I thought, well, I've seen orangutans and elephants and they're as emotionally intelligent
as
we are. So I struggle with that.
I think he's probably shown he doesn't have a soul in that comment.
So we have a job to raise awareness.
But awareness to what end? Because if it is a population growth issue, what are we trying to educate individuals to do?
Sure. I mean, it's a good point. Raising awareness does absolutely nothing. But if raising awareness leads to change in attitudes, which accelerates the growth of financing of antidotes to it, then it has done something.
Along with Bose, In the Pink is sponsored by Tag Heuer, Swiss avant-garde since 1860. Excellence, precision and elegance. Their timepieces are designed for those who love challenges, which is a great fit for this podcast because most of the guests share that sentiment. Okay, my next favourite bit of this series goes to the pocket rocket that is Amy Fuller, snowboarding sensation. And my favourite story from her podcast was about North Korea, would you believe it?
Honestly, I didn't even know that you could go to North Korea, like, casually. I mean, it wasn't really casual, I'm not going to lie. But for me, that was an eye-opener in itself. And that all came about because if I was ever to run a marathon, the year after the Olympics was the year. Mm. And in 2018, I was standing on the London Marathon finish line with Tag Heuer. And I was like, I'd much rather be running this. And the marketing director said, well, yeah, you can next year. And then she messaged me in the November going, okay, so are you actually up for this? And I was like, let me speak to my mum, because I wanted to do it with my mum. My mum was like, give me a few days to decide. She was like, yep, I'm in. So we tackled it together. And it was always something that we had discussed that if we were to ever do it, we would do it together.
That's so nice.
Because we both like running, but, you know, casual runners, like 3-5 miles, never the 26.2 realm. And I posted a story in January after coming back from Japan, actually. And I went for a run in Richmond Park, put it on my story on Instagram and said, I've just run 10 miles, covered in mud, soaking wet, and we got completely lost. And off the back of that, Leah Hervey, who used to work at Sky, now works for the Olympic Channel, saw that I was running London, and she messaged me and said, hey, you don't fancy running another marathon, do you? And I was like, ha, no thanks. And she said, it's in North Korea. And I was like, tell me more. So I remember sitting in my flat with my mum, actually, having this obscure phone call, and it was like, so we want you to front a documentary, and it's going to be about a marathon in North Korea. There's a marathon, a half marathon, and a 10K. And my first question was, can I run the half? And she was like, no. 6 weeks later, I was on a flight to Beijing, having to leave all of my electronics, my phone, any means of communication in China. And then I hopped on a Koryo Air flight, which is a 1-star Russian, ex-Russian plane to North Korea. And it was, yeah, quite the experience.
So what was the point of the documentary? To sort of show how sport is universal and that even behind, you know, the walls.
So essentially, we went into North Korea to peel back the layers behind their sporting system and to showcase how sport really is the universal global language that can bring people together. When we were there, everything else was irrelevant because the sole focus was the sport, and we connected with the people of North Korea through sport. And that opportunity in itself, whilst we were there, opened up so many doors because of the respect of the Olympic body. So we were there with the Olympic Channel creating a documentary around their sport and essentially how they are excelling. And to be honest, the marathon was just the icing on the cake at the end of it all. But we went to meet the gymnasts, the weightlifters, all of their top athletes, along with seeing some very, very strange things.
Like what?
En route. So the first day, we had to go. It was like they had set up like a guided tour. And the first day was the food factory. And we're like, well, why would we go to the food factory? We're not here to see your food. And they were, no, you have to come and see the food factory. So we went and we did this tour. If you imagine like some sort of archaic, icy cold building, it was freezing with all of these little men, you know, on computer screens making the food which the people there eat. So in particular, one of the items that they expressed of importance was French bread. So Sir Kim himself had sent two of his people, which is not normal, out of the country to go and source a recipe for the best French bread. So there we had the French bread. We had chewing gum.
Like a baguette,
yeah.
And they'd recreated the baguette.
Yeah.
Because they'd heard that the French bread's the best in the world.
Yeah, and it was like, we have the best bread. It's made here, and this is the best bread in the world. And they had various other things, but it got stranger. So as we walked around the factory, we went floor by floor up. We ended up on the top floor. So you imagine a factory, you know, industrial factory. You end up on the top floor, and it's a swimming pool, like a tropical oasis, with security guards standing around this pool, waterfalls. But then on top of the factory is the Olympic weightlifting team on their day off, surrounded by security guards. And there was a spread laid out for us. It was beer, chicken feet, white bread, cakes, and sweets. And that is what the athletes were eating on their day off. It was so surreal. And the gentleman who owns the factory wanted us to stay and have dinner with him. And I was like, no, I want to go back to the hotel. So that was just one snippet of the randomness that we experienced. And it's all in the documentary.
So where can we see the documentary?
If you go online, it's literally Olympic Channel, and it's called Running in North Korea.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's about to launch on YouTube as well.
Right, now we have a chance to win, and win big, because you have the opportunity to walk away with a pair of Bose noise-cancelling headphones, the 700 series, worth around £350. All you have to do is rate, review and subscribe. Leave us a review on the In The Pink podcast, on Apple Podcasts and on our Instagram page. We will pick one. Doesn't have to be sycophantic, but that always helps. Make us laugh, give us some feedback on any of our guests, and we will pick someone to walk away with those headphones. Any football fan who enjoys the game will know and love Lee Dixon. Let's hear from him on his aspirations to becoming a coach, a manager even, but also we all know and love his punditry. He's a great storyteller, and he talks to me about Arsene Wenger and the contrasting managerial styles between him and George Graham. How quickly did you bed in with that group of players? Because the defence Arsenal at that time, stuff of legends. I remember chatting to some of my mates at work who were like, oh yeah, if Arsenal went 1-0 up then, that was it. Yeah. You know, because you're never going to get through that defence. How quickly did you surround yourself by these great names like Tony Adams, Martin Keown, well, Winterburn? You obviously knew Steve Bould already, because you'd come down with him, hadn't you?
Yeah. Well, he signed 6 months after me, but it was a very quick learning curve to actually bed into the way that Arsenal played at the time. And George, he was very strict. There was a way of playing. It was completely alien to me, because I was a fullback that showed, I was pretty quick, and as a fullback that showed a winger down the line, because that's why I was being educated. And then all of a sudden, George, on the first day of training, it was at the indoor training centre at Highbury, and it was freezing cold because I signed in the February. So it was like cold outside, we couldn't train because the pitches were frozen. Go inside and we do this like little session, and they kept shouting in to me. In his Scottish voice. I go to sleep sometimes at night having nightmares about him shouting at me, still to this day, because he was going, in! And I was going, in what? Why are you saying that? So I said to Dave Rocastle, bless him, who again is not with us, and I said to him, what's he keep saying in for? What's that? I don't know what that means. And he went, oh, it's inside. You have to show everybody inside so you don't get beat down the outside. So me playing on the right, I could not let anyone go down the wing. I had to show him inside the middle of the pitch, because that's how we played. It was where our strength was. Don't get beat on the outside. Show everybody inside. And I was like, And it was so alien to me to try and do that, because it was just natural to go show him down the line. No, and he used to basically fine you if you got beat down the outside. He said, right, I'm going to fine. Do not let people get crosses in. You show them inside. You show them inside. In. It was like, and then he'd whack you, metaphorically, whack you with a stick if you didn't do what he said. And that's his way of coaching. Mm. But his coaching sessions on the pitch were so intense, and you had to pick it up quickly. It's a little bit like, I'm married to a beautiful lady in my life now called Yolanda, who's a dancer, and she can relate to that picking up. It's like picking up steps, and I can't dance to save my life, but you know, a choreographer, here's your steps and you have to learn it straight away, and if you don't, you're out. And it was basically George Graham's choreography was show inside, press the ball. There was triggers to go and press the ball. There was, you had to learn them. It was a little bit like NFL playbook. This is what happens when the ball's there, you're there, you do. It's very regimented. And if you didn't learn it, you know, there was, you fortunately, I'd, you know, unlike my dancing, I'm quite quick at learning patterns on a football pitch. And I guess that's why I then go on to do what I do now, which is talking about those patterns and trying to not teach. I hate that word, like teach people.
Yeah, but it is type of teaching.
But it's only what I know, so it's not gospel. And there's loads of different ways of doing it.
And it's your interpretation of it.
Correct.
But, yeah, but
it's like the ability to show you or what I know that's in my head when I see a pattern. I go, I would do this. This is what I think you should do. I had success doing it this way. Then if somebody understands that at home and a light bulb goes off and goes, oh, I get that now, why that player might have done that or something. I guess that's what I learned under George. It was understanding them, that pattern on the pitch. So,
And the discipline that he brought, presumably just like impose. Oh yeah, you see, that facial expression says it all, because it's like you still remember that discipline even now.
Yeah.
But it's now ingrained in you because of it.
See,
which is a good thing, you know, like
yeah, and patterns. It is ingrained, and I miss a little bit that in my.
Here's a cool fact: a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact: you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In my life now, and I mean that because I was with him 2 weeks ago at the Tottenham game, and we did a charity box, 15 people, you know, paid money to charity to watch a game with me and George Graham, and I hosted it, and George was the jewel in the crown, because I knew, even at, you know, he's 70 odd, even at now, he's so passionate about the game, and he recognises the game's moved on, and he's a bit old school, but the game hasn't changed, and it's about how many you put in one end and how many you keep out at the other. That'll never change. And until you do both reasonably well, you won't win anything. You can, Man City are brilliant going forward, Liverpool are brilliant going forward, but they still both know what to do without the ball. And his big thing was get that balance right. And he was a little bit more the defensive side, make sure you don't give anything away and then nick one at the other end, 1-0 to the Arsenal. Mm. Arsene is the flip, complete flip of that. He's attacking, great-looking football, brilliant, open, freestyle, gunplay type, but he couldn't coach a back four as long as he's got two ears and a nose.
So, but how difficult was that then for you to adjust to that style of management?
Easiest thing ever, because
he left you to your own devices.
Yeah, because when he's a hugely intelligent man, Arsene, and came in and went, why? He knew us anyway before. Yeah. He always tells a story. He says, I knew you lot, you know, because he's a football nutcase. He watches videos. He'll watch videos of Arsenal for years and years. So when he came from Grand Passé, he knew all about us. Mm. He said to me, I'm a bit surprised that you're actually a better footballer than I thought. I thought you were just like, you know,
brick wall.
Yeah, a load of grow bags at the back going, like, just winning the ball.
I heard he actually said you're better looking in the flesh as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You're testament to that. I can see you looking at me now going, no, he's wrong.
I tell you what, though, growing up, I was bloody scared of the back four at Arsenal. Keown and Tony Adams, they were
scary,
yeah.
Aren't they?
Whoa.
Yeah. Nigel Winterburn as well. Not a looker.
Lovely. No. Another chance to win on In the Pink. Tag Heuer are giving away 4 Premier League tickets of your choice for 2020. So all you need to do is rate, review, subscribe. Make sure that you review on Apple Podcasts and our Instagram page. We will pick a comment, a review, some feedback, and you could be walking away the proud owner of 4 Premier League tickets to a game of your choice. Happy days. Right, next up on In the Pink Best Bits, Lee McKenzie. A bit different, this podcast, because we just chat about what it's like to be in the F1 paddock, particularly about being a woman in what's really a male-dominated world. I also enjoyed what she said about Michael Schumacher and how she really connected with him. So, enjoy Lee Mack's Best Bit.
I'll start off with the good points. Okay. Loved interviewing Michael Schumacher, and I got on well with Michael, I think, and I took a horse over to Switzerland to his ranch and take part and stuff, and, you know, stayed over there, and his kids and his wife, and I liked Michael, you know, to interview because he was honest, and he'd come up with great lines like, you know, I think I've just made you famous. And I'm like, okay, thank you for that. When he answered something which then got put in all the newspapers and all the rest of it. And I was like, thank you. Yeah, thanks for that.
But you probably also had that extra bond because of the horses, didn't
you?
Yeah,
I think so. But I think he was someone that didn't suffer fools gladly. Mm. And I have the same with Sebastian. Mm. You know, Sebastian and I have had some ridiculous interviews where he's like gone to give out my phone number on TV and everybody knows them. There was a time where every interview I was doing with him was getting into the papers for probably all the wrong reasons. But I get on very well with Sebastian, but I can be very honest in a question with him because I know that he is actually clever enough to handle it. Mm. You know, I think I would ask the same question to every single driver differently because you know how what Lewis would need in a question, you know what Daniel will need in a question, you know what Seb will need, for example, those three. So you would ask the same question, but in a different way for each driver. Mm. Some drivers, you might have to go in with a slight ego massage before you get to the hard one, but it's all about knowing who you're talking to.
Mm. No, I totally agree. The only thing I would, as a sort of caveat for that, is that when the race has just finished and they're all piling into the pen and you're scrabbling around through your notes and trying to remember, and actually you've got to, if the FOM director hasn't focused on a certain person's race and they walk towards you and stand in front of you thinking, I haven't got an effing clue what's just happened in your race.
You can't say to them, actually, we didn't see you at all.
No.
In 72 laps, we haven't seen you once.
Yeah.
Must try harder.
But you've got to go, so how would you sum up your race?
Yeah, there's a generic one. And then sometimes they say something like, well, it was, it was all going well till I got the puncture in lap 23 or, you know, I was hit by the Haas or something. I think we didn't see it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, perception of a race is actually a director's perception of a race until you get, like, you know, on the Monday afternoon replays suddenly pop up all over social media and then you ended up getting trolled because you didn't ask the right question.
Yeah, but it is hot. I mean, you know, and Lewis can be the trickiest in this respect because on the one hand, sometimes he'll come in and he will be in that mood where whatever you say, he will say, nah, I disagree. And so sometimes you just want to go, come on, just here's the microphone, you speak. But we are the conduit for him to his fans. Yeah. So he knows that he needs us to speak to them. And we obviously need him because we need his interview because, you know, particularly for the British audience, he's the most important driver. So what little tips, and I'm definitely going to write these down, do you have for interviewing Lewis? Because
well, Lewis
actually,
has
I find
changed.
Him, I find him so warm sometimes and just yeah. so giving, and he wears his heart on his sleeve. And when he is grumpy and something does go wrong, he does get a lot of abuse on social media saying, come on, don't sulk. Because I never forget, in contrast to that, when Daniel crashed out of a race, I said to him, oh, you know, God, you must be pretty devastated by today. He goes, my bad day is still anyone else's great day. And yeah. I thought, how lovely, you know, what an amazing sort of spin to put on a situation when it's just happened. But Lewis, you have to respect that he actually just tells you as it is. And when he's pissed off, he tells you.
Yeah, but I think, you know, from when Lewis came into Formula One in 2008, was it 2008? 2007, sorry.
Seven, yeah.
That to where he is now, he is a completely different person. Mm. He's matured an awful lot. How he used to answer questions and what he went through, say, 09 at McLaren when in the sort of, you know, the named Liegate and things like that. You know, he's been through an awful lot in his career. Mm. And, you know, it's not all been a bed of roses. I did that interview, which ended up on the front page of every newspaper with Lewis in Monaco, when I asked him about why he thought he was so magnetic to the stewards after one Monaco Grand Prix, and he said, maybe it's because I'm black. And that's a good example of Lewis fans absolutely hated me. I mean, I received death threats. And Formula One fans then hated Lewis because he was bringing the sport into disrepute and all the rest of it. And I sent an email to Anthony, his father, and to sort of just explain why I asked that question, mm. just in case Lewis. I didn't apologise for it because that's my job. Mm. And then the next race was Canada, and everybody was filming me as Lewis walked up to me, which was really bizarre. And then he just gave me a big hug, and we cleared the air, and we moved straight on. Mm. But you know, I wouldn't do any of that differently. I would still ask him the question, and then I would still keep going. And ask that question, and then it's up to a press officer or somebody to pull him out or for him to walk away. So I wouldn't change that now. I mean, Lewis, I think, is actually fine. Sometimes you can interview him and you'll say, you know, it doesn't happen very often, but you know, you're third on the grid. I know you always want to be first, so you always give him that little thing. And then he'll be like, best lap I could ever have done. And you're like, what? Okay, that just blows you away. And yet sometimes you can say to him, like, you know, that you never suggest it was the perfect lap, because a driver never has a perfect lap in them, sort of, or they have the perfect lap in them, but they never achieve it. And again, he doesn't suffer fools gladly either. But I do think how he interviews, I've seen him with how he speaks to the German press and other press, and he's certainly much more trusting with the Brits.
Okay, next up on In the Pink Best Bits, it's James Blunt. My favourite quote from this podcast was, posh people have feelings too, don't you know? And many of you picked up on that, which was great. James Blunt's Twitter bants is on another level, and he took a few established names in the music industry to task on social media. So that was probably my favourite bit of his podcast. I'm going to start with your tweets, because anyone who's been living under a rock may not know that you are a prolific tweeter, but a very smart one as well. And funny enough, it's sort of social media in a strange way kind of brought you back into people's consciousness. In, you know, obviously your music did a lot of that and more of that later. But okay, I'm just going to give you a flavour for anyone who hasn't read James's tweets. Obviously follow him, you ridiculous fools, for not doing so earlier. James Blunt has an annoying face and highly irritating voice. You retweeted that and said...
I said, and no mortgage.
Beautiful. And why does James Blunt sing like his willy is being stood on? And you retweeted and said...
Damn things always getting caught under my feet.
Beautiful. But my personal favourite, and I think you should read the whole thing. This genuinely brought a tear to my eye. You might not remember this verbatim, so I'm going to just bring it up on my phone for you. It was when Keith Flint died. Now, please read us that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I felt this is quite a sad tweet. It's not really a fun one in many ways. And it brings back some sad memories, but some positive ones too. It's about Keith Flint. And I wrote at the time of his death saying, at the Q Awards years ago, when Noel Gallagher was saying he was leaving Ibiza because I'd moved there, and Damon Albarn refused to be in the same picture as me, which is true, and Paul Weller was saying he'd rather eat his own shit than work with me, Keith Flint came over, gave me a hug, and said how thrilled he was for my success. Keith, I only met you once, but I shed a tear at the news of your death. In our business, there are no prizes for being kind, but if there was, that Grammy would be yours.
James also talks about the emotion that went into writing Monsters, that incredible song for his dad, who has a chronic illness. And it's effectively a eulogy for someone who's still living, and it's amazing. And I don't think I've ever listened to that song and not welled up. So that was my other favourite bit of James Blunt's podcast.
I came off an 18-month world tour the end of September 2018. And it was round about that time that we realised my dad was unwell. He had stage 4 chronic kidney disease. And so almost immediately, I had stuff to write about. You know, this is a man who's been really fit, healthy in army, colonel, a helicopter pilot in the army, and you know, was just an incredibly fit human being. And so immediately that tour finished, I went into the studio in October 2018. I locked myself away for, you know, almost a year and wrote songs for him. But also when I realised I don't have much time necessarily with him, limited time with him, I look around at my new family that I've just had, a tiny little family. And me, you know, if I'm on an 18-month tour, I'm on tours that are longer than they are old. So not even knowing these people and meeting them. So realising I have limited time with them, and that's quite inspiring in itself to write songs. I'm writing songs in case I should never see them again, and messages to them that I can only write to them in songs because I'm not seeing them face to face. And also, of course, there's someone at the heart of it who has to pick up all the pieces of that, and that's my wife. So I've written a bunch of songs for her.
So specifically, Monsters is about your dad, isn't it? And how hard and or helpful was it to write that?
It wasn't hard to write because I didn't have to imagine it. Suddenly there is, you know, this man who's becoming more frail. He'd tell me to piss off if he was here and say I'm fine. But he's, you know, when you see that and those chapters start to change in one's life and you see the circle of life play out in front of you, it's really easy to write those kind of songs. If there was pressure, though, it was to make sure like I nailed it, you know, because you can't write 5 songs all touching on the subject. If you're going to play that song to your father at some stage, you need to get that one song and make it matter. And Monsters is that song.
It's amazing, actually, because there's a line in the song, and forgive me if I get it, it's not quite verbatim, but it's basically you're almost talking to him as an equal rather than father and son.
Exactly.
You're two men standing in front of each other.
Yeah.
Which I think.
And the lyric says, I'm not your son, you're not my father. We're just two grown men saying goodbye. No need to forgive. No need to forget. I know your mistakes and you know mine. And you know, they're quite raw things to say. And when I first played it to him, I hoped he wasn't going to take it in the wrong way. But it's saying that you are more to me than my father. You're my friend as well.
I have to say that I listened to that last night when I was just thinking about talking to you, and I thought a lot about my own dad, and I just burst into tears. I feel like there's a real kind of vulnerability to our parents now, particularly as they're getting older and things are starting to go wrong for them physically. You know, you talk about the circle of life, and when you have kids, that just it's just sharpened in your own mind, isn't it?
Yeah, entirely that. And they're kind of beautiful. They're chapters in a life. They're shifting moments. You go from idolising a parent to being an equal, and then you have to look after them in a way that they looked after you.
Yeah.
Finally, on In the Big Best Bits, it's everybody's favourite tennis sensation, the pin-up girl, the poster girl of British tennis, Annabelle Croft. And I particularly enjoyed her take on who we should look forward to seeing coming through the tennis ranks, some of the stars of the present and future. And then she gives a great tip on healthy living, the secret to healthy living. And she was inspired by Novak Djokovic, no less. So, what is it? Well, better listen to find out.
you know, when I see people with psoriasis, I have a great cameraman friend of mine, she has terrible psoriasis, and he's always buying you know, stuff in America when we're over there, and I'm always saying to him, oh, please try a different approach. But I don't know whether he has or not. I'll have to ask him. But I did pass on one tip, and I'll pass it on here, because why not? And it was Novak Djokovic, actually, who put up an Instagram post about celery juice. And I'd never heard about this celery juice phenomenon. Mm. And he was saying, this is my little secret. I'm going to let you into a secret. The medical medium, who's somebody that I'd never heard of, I think helps him with all his health and swears by drinking celery juice every morning. Anyway, I then click on medical medium and I thought, I want to know more about this chap who helps Novak Djokovic. And the more I read about him, and the more that you look at what he does with health, and it's all about natural health, it's quite, it's phenomenal how many people he helps. Millions and millions of people, and hundreds of thousands will be going through his timeline saying how much this celery juice has helped them. Anyway, one of my children had the most horrific, like, cluster of warts on her elbow, and it literally was disgusting. And it looked like a cauliflower, but with lots of, like, you know, different
just
parts.
Just in one spot.
On her left elbow. It was absolutely horrific. And we'd had it burnt off professionally, and then it came back twice as big. And then I went to a Chinese medical place, and they said, oh, you must never just chop these things off, because it's a virus. It sits in your gut. And if you take off the top layer, it's like the branches of a tree. It will just grow through twice as big, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And honestly, she couldn't go out with it. She had to put a plaster on it. It was embarrassing. She looked like she had a deformed elbow. Anyway, the more I read on this medical medium website, I was also at the Instagram page, I thought, well, actually what warts are is the HPV virus. Mm. So for any parents listening out there, I mean, even your own kids, they may one day pick up warts at school or whatever. They're horrible. I had no idea they were the HPV virus. And she'd had it for 8 years, this great big unsightly thing on her elbow. Anyway, I thought, you know what? Stuff it. I'm going to go and buy a masticating juicer. I bought a cheap one because I thought, well, who knows? It probably won't work, but I'll give it a go. And I went and bought bunch after bunch of celery, juicing it away in our kitchen. And I never thought my daughter would drink it, but you have to take it first thing in the morning before you put
anything else
in your stomach. She drank 16 ounces of it every day. Within 2 to 3 weeks, the thing it's completely gone. And it's, if I showed you the pictures, you'd be quite shocked. And I do show people a lot because they can't believe that what was there and now that it's completely disappeared. And I'm like, well, this is really, it's a bit freaky because it was so enormous and very, very thick and very protruding, but it's completely gone. So I take out of that what you will. But if you look on his site, he will help acne, he'll help psoriasis, eczema, lots of skin conditions, and then many other chronic ailments. So I don't know. There's something in celery juice.
Do you put anything else in? Just
bunches of it. I mean, I've left it out there. You'll see it in the kitchen today. My other daughter was drinking it this morning. But you just do a bunch of celery every day. But you can take it with other things. But to attack an ailment, you need to drink it pure. And it's something to do with the cluster salt that's in celery attacks the viruses that are sitting in the gut, and it pulls them all out. And I think it takes all the metals out of your system and all the toxins and everything. And I have to say, if you drink it, you'll be needing to go to the loo pretty quickly. It flushes your whole system. Yeah. It's amazing. But anyway, I thought I'd pass the tip on because there might be people that listen who have awful ailments and don't know what's going on with their body. But
Definitely, because I think you definitely go through life just going, well, this is just what I've got.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? You go, I've always had backache. Yeah. Or I've always, you know, suffered from headaches, whatever. You shouldn't have to put up with it. And actually, if you just maybe take a different approach rather than going to your GP.
It's interesting.
Really interesting.
When we finish this podcast, I'll show you the pictures and I think you'll be quite shocked.
I will. Okay, so that's it for this podcast. In the Pink, best bits of the series. If you disagree with any that we've chosen, please let us know. And you've still got the chance to win those Bose noise-cancelling headphones and Premier League tickets, thanks to Tag Heuer. Thank you for your company. Thank you for your feedback. It's been brilliant. Really enjoyed it. See you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.